It's 2:06 on Wednesday afternoon. Dr. Andra Gillespie, who just raced into the studio, you are a busy person. Oh, I didn't mean that as a bad thing. We just want you, your voice on the air. It doesn't matter if you arrive a minute early or 20 minutes early. That is Dr. Andra Gillespie. She, of course, is a political science professor at Emory University, and we're always glad to have her here no matter what time she arrives at
the
studio. Greg Bluestein from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, political reporter over there, is here today. Greg, thank you for being here. You've got some really interesting stories with your name on them this week that we're going to get to as we talk today.
It's been another fun week. As I tell everyone, job security.
Michael Owens, the chairman of the Cobb County Democratic Party, is back with us. Thanks for being here, Michael.
Hey, as always, pleasure to be here.
And Loretta Lepore. She's a Republican strategist, has done a lot of work in government relations, particularly on issues that relate to transportation. Loretta, you pointed out to me that I had one of those great senior moments in the opening of this show that I should, Senator David Perdue. I called him Senator Tom Perdue because I was thinking back to the great Democratic political consultant Tom Perdue here in Georgia. So thank you for making sure I got that corrected.
Absolutely. My pleasure. It's nice to be the one editing every once in a while.
Yeah, I get that. You can tweet us at PoliticsGPB. And in fact, I hope you do, because I want to get your feedback on a couple of the stories that we're going to talk about today. So, for instance, in a minute, we're going to start by discussing this episode in the United States Senate last night in which the majority leader, Senator Mitch McConnell, forced Senator Elizabeth Warren to sit down and stop talking because she was reading from a statement that Coretta Scott King had made about Jeff Sessions. We're going to talk about that in a minute. But tweet us. Who got the better of that? Was McConnell correct that decorum prevails? But more important, do you think that the Democrats got the better of that from a political point of view because perhaps it's not wise to attack the writing of Coretta Scott King? We'll talk about that story. We'll talk about the fact that David Perdue, in a partnership with Tom Cotton, Senator Tom Cotton, is sponsoring a bill that would limit legal immigration in the country. So let us know whether you think that's a good idea. Throughout the show, tweet us, PoliticsGPB. Greg, let's start, though, with the Elizabeth Warren-Mitch McConnell story. So last night, there is a floor debate going on about Jeff Sessions, right?
Yeah, these were Democrat senators who were fighting to derail Jeff Sessions' nomination, which is likely to come within the next few hours. And Elizabeth Warren stands up, and she starts reading a critical letter about Jeff Sessions from Martin Luther King Jr.'s widow, Coretta Scott King, that was written about three decades ago. And when she was ordered to sit down, throwing the Senate into turmoil, Mitch McConnell essentially silenced her.
Yeah, let's listen to how that exchange unfolded and then discuss it.
Mr. President.
The Majority Leader.
Senators impugn the motives and conduct of our colleague from Alabama as warned by the chair. Senator Warren, quote, said Senator Sessions has used the awesome power of his office to chill the free exercise of the vote by black citizens. I call the senator to order under the provisions of Rule 19.
Mr. President.
The senator from Massachusetts.
Mr. President, I am surprised that the words of Coretta Scott King are not suitable for debate in the United States Senate. I ask leave of the Senate to continue my remarks.
Is there objection?
Object.
I appeal the ruling.
Objection is heard. The senator will take her seat.
Mr. President, I appeal the ruling of the chair, and I suggest the absence of a quorum.
The clerk will call the roll.
So, Andra Gillespie, the roll was called, and in fact, the Senate voted along strictly party lines that Elizabeth Warren should, in fact, have to sit down and be quiet, and by Senate rule, she's forbidden from having anything more to say as long as the Sessions confirmation is the topic of the agenda. What's interesting about this, Andra, is that Senator McConnell quoted Elizabeth Warren saying, here's what she, Elizabeth Warren, said about Jeff Sessions. In fact, she was quoting from the letter, the statement that Coretta Scott King sent to Senator Strom Thurmond years ago when Jeff Sessions was a nominee for a federal judgeship.
And I think the irony of this is, one, that letter is in the congressional record, and two, that issue was what sunk his judgeship 30 years ago. So it's not like, you know, he was just making stuff up. It wasn't like she was talking about his mother or anything else that, you know, or saying he was a horrible person. She's just reading words there. So I think it is an example of how toxic our political environment has become, that you can't read a letter that's been up for debate. Like, it's okay to have the debate about, you know, the merits of that case and whether or not Senator Sessions did the things that he was accused of doing 30 years ago. But I think it's hard to say that she was impugning his character sort of based on the letter of the law that was used to invoke silencing Senator Warren last night.
Loretta, here was the another statement from that letter that Coretta Scott King sent to Senator Strom Thurmond back March 19th, 1986. The irony of Mr. Sessions' nomination back then is that if confirmed, he'll be given life tenure for doing with a federal prosecution what the local sheriffs accomplished 20 years ago with clubs and cattle prods. Your take on this, Loretta?
Well, Elizabeth Warren, throughout this process, with most of the president's nominees, has been pretty incendiary in the committee meetings. With regard to what she was bringing to the floor, she was asked not to do it before she did it. And when she did leave the floor, she went directly to Facebook and read the full letter over on through Facebook. So there were different ways for her certainly to express herself and her opinion outside of the confines of the Senate floor. And, you know, she was trying to be incendiary. And according to the rules, then the senator that is impugned is supposed to be able to come back and make their own comments in defense of themselves. But this is a unique situation because you have a nominee who is a fellow senator, which if it were somebody who wasn't a senator, the rules may be different.
Well, I think that's one of the things there are many things about this we can discuss, but that's one of the interesting aspects of this, Michael. Was Jeff Sessions in this moment last night a member of the United States Senate or a fair game nominee for Attorney General of the United States?
I think without a doubt he was a nominee. And I think what Senator Warren brought up was indeed relevant to the conversation, what was going on. As Dr. Gillespie said, it was public record. And it's something that she absolutely should have been able to read. I mean, the idea of the one thing that we now know is that we're all getting like another civics lesson, right, on what all these different things
rule
mean.
Rule 19.
You know, Senate Rule 19, what is that, right? I think the Washington Post might have called it like an arcane, seldom used, you know, rule that's very rarely brought up for anything. But, you know, it brings to light now, right? I mean, you know, it's just going to be interesting to continue to watch these things as they unfold. And this was definitely one of them.
And it is a seldom used rule. I mean, yeah. And that's part of the debate going on right now is the hypocrisy from both sides. You know, Ted Cruz called Mitch McConnell a liar and that rule wasn't invoked.
Sure.
David Perdue made fun of Chuck Schumer, you know, not too long ago. And that rule wasn't invoked. And it was invoked last night. And that's part of the reason why I think Let Liz Speak has become sort of a rallying cry for Democrats right now.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, a rallying cry, because we should really be focusing, I think, on the optics of this. Mm-hmm. Because what we've just talked about, was the rule invoked in an appropriate manner, all that, that's fine. But this is really a question of optics.
Well, and I think it actually is really helpful. You know, people think that right now Elizabeth Warren is a front runner for 2020 for the Democratic nomination. It's much, much, much too early to be talking about that. But this is the type of thing that could be used as a rallying cry for Democrats. And if Warren wanted to use it personally for her own self-promotion, she absolutely can. Because, you know, while I understand that the charges are quite serious, you know, she was speaking in a really calm manner. So it wasn't like she was, you know, standing up on the floor of the Senate, kind of like, you know, yelling and waving a handkerchief or something like that. And so for it to have been invoked in that type of situation, when she was speaking calmly and when she was invoking the words of the widow of the late great civil rights hero, I mean, I think some people might argue that it might have been a bit too much.
Yeah, Yeah, I've heard both sides of this, right? That Senator Warren may have went in with an agenda, right, to create
she
a national
had an
story.
Agenda.
But at the same token, the Republicans obviously knew what they were doing, but try to censor her while she's talking about the words from, you know, Coretta Scott King.
Right.
I mean, how worse of an opportunity can you choose? Right, to bring this up as an issue and invoke an archaic rule like Rule 19, when there's been, you know, many other instances where it could have been invoked in the past, but why choose now, right, as a moment where you want to take this on and create?
Yeah, I think, Loretta, the Democrats are licking their chops. They see this for a couple of reasons. One, why do you stop, as has already been said? Coretta Scott King, especially here in Georgia, a figure, a revered figure.
Absolutely. But,
and then
she
you
is.
Tell a woman to sit down and shut up. Neither of those look great for the Republicans in the Senate, do they?
Okay, so to break that down, yes, I think that, you know, we do all revere Coretta Scott King and all that she did through her lifetime to advance civil rights. And I think Elizabeth Warren is a very smart woman. She knew exactly what she was doing by choosing to read Coretta Scott King's letter. So she knew that she was going to create a certain tone that was going to offend many. I think Republicans in the Senate are just fed up with Democrats and what they are calling juvenile behavior, with senators not showing up to confirmation hearings, drawing out these confirmation hearings. And Elizabeth Warren, throughout, since the president's been inaugurated, she's been a very, very vocal person trying to rally her base for bigger points and bigger initiatives. And she chose this opportunity to do that. And Republicans asked her not to do that before it. It had nothing to do with her being a female. You know, they've said you have every right. You can listen to any of the senators today that have been on the talk shows talking about it. She has every right to free speech. She has every right to raise these issues outside the confines of the Senate floor. And we were going to check her on that.
And let me add, too, that this very same debate we're having here erupted on the Georgia Senate floor this morning.
Yeah, tell us about that, actually.
Yeah, State Senator Vincent Fort, who's running for Atlanta mayor, who is never shy about speaking in public or looking for the cameras, went and read the very same letter about under the five-minute mark that senators are allowed speaking privileges, got it in, there was no objections. Then a few speakers later, Senator Josh Bakun, Republican, who's also probably running for higher office, stands up and says how inappropriate it was for Senator Warren to make that statement last night. And he called it terribly inappropriate and, you know, kind of hewed to the Republican line against him. So there was a very small sort of Georgia version of that debate that unfolded today.
I mean, I think ultimately at the end of the day, the question is, will this have any effect? And we already know it's not going to have an effect. Jeff Sessions is going to be the attorney general. I think the optics, in fact, do matter. And I think that there is something important about the substance of the Democratic senators kind of uniting together to at least try to persuade their colleagues on the merits of the case. And this is why I think the Coretta Scott King letter is important. So we can debate whether or not this incident happened as it did. And there are people on both sides of this incident who have different accounts of what was going on. But it's important to know that Jeff Sessions has a track record where there are a lot of civil rights leaders who actually have taken issue with the record that he did when he was working in Alabama and who didn't always see him as an ally. Yes, he has his defenders, but he also has his detractors. And it's those detractors that have persuaded Democrats that they should not support his candidacy. And I think that that was at the essence of what Senator Warren was trying to do. Were there optics? Yes. Would they have silenced a male Democratic senator who probably would have tried the same thing? Yes, but it looks different when you're doing it to a woman. I mean, it just does, especially in this politically charged environment.
And remember, too, the last time we had one of these incidents kind of bubble up and make huge national news on the floor in Congress was John Lewis's sit-in. And there was, at the same time, there was hashtags, there was lots of talk about this really changing the debate over gun legislation. And we haven't seen that at all yet. So.
Ted sure. Barfield tweets, do senators not know the parliamentary rules of the Senate? Who is that telling the presiding president exactly what to say? Catherine Cummings says invoking Rule 19 is sexist and hypocritical. Everyone has an agenda in the Senate. Men didn't want to hear a woman. They're tweeting us at PoliticsGPB. So there's a countervailing argument. We got a tweet, for instance, from Georgia News Online. Senator Warren should send him, McConnell, a gift. He made her look good and himself look bad. Sit down, little lady, and let the men talk. Okay, so here's the countervailing argument. You said Elizabeth Warren may very well be a front runner for the 2020 nomination. there's this theory that has been making the rounds in Washington today that the Republicans, in fact, set her up, that they love the idea that it might be Elizabeth Warren, the very liberal senator from Massachusetts, who will take on Donald Trump for his re-election bid. And it's an interesting theory, at the least, Greg Bluestein.
That is quite the chess game.
That really is.
It is being talked about in Washington by those talking heads on the cable networks.
I guess it's something to talk about. That is three plus
well,
years.
Well, one question she did receive from a reporter on one of the cable networks was, how much money have you raised in the past 24 hours?
Yeah.
And which she refused to answer, you know, so that's not what this is about. But it was a, you know, you could say that was a cynical question by a reporter, but it was also very real. And especially given the fact that they're trying to also elect, you know, the chairman of the Democratic Party. And there's a great divide right now amongst Democrats about who that's going to be. And the Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren part of the party, you know, they're trying to get all their folks activated. And so there's a lot of different dynamics at play right now.
Yeah.
Yeah, but there's a lot to be said with that, you know, that there's that much forethought going into it, that by Elizabeth Warren doing this, that the Republicans were going to censor her, which would then elevate, you know, there's a lot. There's that maybe reaching there a bit, but, you know, you never know. But I think that rift is, you know, people will continue to talk about it. There's no doubt about that. But the fact of going forward, Elizabeth Warren is a strong member, you know, of the Democratic Senate, and she will remain to be. She's not going to, you know, be quiet and go by the wayside. She's going to continue to be a force and a strength.
So, Greg, I said that these remarks by Elizabeth Warren came actually during debate last night. It wasn't really a debate. This was another evening in which Democratic members of the Senate, as they'd done the night before with Betsy DeVos, education secretary, gave a series of speeches just to continue to call attention to what they see as the issues with some of these cabinet nominees. It could be today that there will be a vote on the floor of the Senate that will confirm Jeff Sessions. And given the power that Republicans now wield in the United States Senate, he will be the Attorney General.
He will be the Attorney General, and he'll probably be the Attorney General with some Democratic votes. I don't know if the party will stand in lockstep against him. We'll see. And that is part of the delaying tactic Democrats are using that is also pushing back Tom Price's confirmation vote until maybe tomorrow, maybe early Friday. So we'll see.
And then you have the Treasury Secretary behind him, yeah. Steve Mnuchin, won't get confirmed until Tom Price is confirmed.
I mean, but so much of it is you know, a delay tactic. I look at it as a way as it's a way of Democrats raising their awareness and having a full discussion and debate on these nominees. You know, just the fact of rushing them through and getting it signed off because you have enough votes there. That's not what Democrats are going to do. And I'm applauding the Democratic Party for being willing to hold these debates open.
So I understand. All right. That's a great point to make because I understand that, Andra. I do get the Democrats with no power at all on the Hill right now want to make bold statements and try to get their message across. Mm-hmm. But that may, in fact, this strategy may not help them really push through to the very voters who Donald Trump won in the election in November. You know, there's something to be said for the possibility that what they maybe could have done was to say, we have tremendous issues with Jeff Sessions. We are going to watch him closely. We know that you have the votes to confirm his nomination. Here are the things that we oppose. The question is whether intransigence is really the best Democratic strategy for any of these nominees, including Betsy DeVos.
Well, so, I mean, I think there's intransigence, and then I think there's looking like you're being intransigent. And I think what Democrats are counting on is the fact that Donald Trump won with a plurality vote. He didn't win a majority of the vote. So there may be some latent Democrats out there dispersed in the right way in certain parts of the country where they're going to try to reach out to and speak out for those issues. And I also think that some of the issues that are at stake that these candidates embodied in particular is also really important. So Jeff Sessions and voting rights, Betsy DeVos and charter schools, you know, Andy Pudster and thinking about minimum wage and working conditions. These are all things that if they didn't speak out, the Democratic base would be looking at them wondering why they're kind of capitulating. So the fact that they're standing up is something that's important. I think also just from a procedural standpoint, delay is an issue. So at this point, These nominations haven't been delayed enough relative to other presidents that I think you would be worried. But if they could procedurally delay things, which, you know, is their right to do, and Republicans delayed plenty of stuff when they were in the minority, this could actually have implications for how the executive branch operates. Mm-hmm. And so we're already seeing that work, because it's not just the cabinet stuff that's actually important. It's also those lower level positions that aren't getting filled.
Thousands of them.
That procedurally and just from an organizational management standpoint is in fact really troubling. And so I think what they are hoping to do, some of that is on the Trump administration, because not all of these people actually need confirmation.
Right.
But I think what Democrats are counting on is that the Trump administration is so inefficient that they can't deliver on their promises, and that that disillusions his base, and that that actually riles up the Democratic base.
We got some go ahead.
I think that Andrea raises a good point in the delay of those appointments that are below cabinet level, because there are certain programs that are not going to get administered that are vital to people's lives. And so when you look at the deputy secretary levels and you look at the undersecretaries and then you look at all the people below that are administering actual programs, you have civil servants in there that are continuing the day-to-day work of the government. But at some point, that flips. That flips when somebody doesn't get a check that they were counting on. And, you know, whether it's a veteran or whether it's a single mother. And then it becomes about the Democrats holding up that check.
So I don't know if it's as much as that as thus far with the people that are running the White House executive office right now are full of a lot of people who have not served in Washington or in office in any capacity. So, you know, to me, they need to have the deputy secretaries and other people that's actually been there for a while so that when they do sign these executive orders and all this stuff comes down, you actually have people that know how to implement them and have people that have some experience. And right now, they don't have that. So they may want to just hold off on executive orders until they have more people that understand how to
That reminds me of that brutal New York Times story that ran over the weekend that said that some of the White House staffers didn't even know how to turn on the lights. They didn't know how to find the exits. Of course, the Trump administration has pushed back hard against that. But still, that's at least one of the major stories out
there. And it was a great image, too, because it talked about the meeting late at night in the West Wing in the darkness because
they couldn't turn on the lights.
We're going to take a break. As we do, though, lots of tweets coming in. Elizabeth, who tweets at EA Kelly 72, says this will be beneficial for Warren. Yes. However, these actions are divisive, stalemate for yes, no progress. Well, we'll see about that. Maria Pegler says, while it may not affect Sessions' confirmation, it continues to rally women in the U.S. I think that's probably correct.
It depends on which women you're talking about. So I think the types of women who went to the Women's March, absolutely. I mean, and that turnout was massive if you think about sort of collectively what that meant in terms of the U.S. population. Not all women were on board with that, though. And so I think that that's important to sort of tease out. And so I would just say that that is an empirical question, which we can all test later.
one more, because she makes an important point. Southern Belle, who tweets at Shad Tree, says, love this program. Thank you. Wish there was a way that speakers could be identified for latecomers. Guess what? We're going to take a break right now at 2:30 on this Wednesday afternoon. And when we come back, we're going to identify our panelists today for the latecomers. I'm Bill Nigut. This is Political Rewind.
The new animated documentary Tower tells the story of the 1966 mass shooting at the University of Texas, when a sniper in a tower at the heart of campus opened fire, killing 16 and wounding 36 others. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with the director, Keith Maitland, and Claire Wilson James, the first person shot in the attack. She was 18 and pregnant at the time. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 on your GPB station.
We're back on Political Rewind. I'm here with Dr. Andra Gillespie. Say hello so everybody hears your voice.
Hi.
Joining us late. Thank you, Andra. Michael Owens, chairman of the Democratic Party of Cobb County. Michael?
Hello, everyone, including you in Twitterland.
Loretta Laporte, a Republican strategist and a government relations, professional.
That sounds good.
Works often on transportation issues. And Greg Bluestein, political reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.
Hello.
See his byline everywhere. We've said this many times, he's the hardest working man in journalistic show business, a frequent contributor.
You're making me blush.
To the AJC Political Insider blog, which you can read at ajc.com. This is a good time for me to point out that we have a great partnership now with Political Insider blog. It's another way you can listen to Political Rewind when you're not near the radio. Every show is now posted on the blog and available for you to hear there. And, of course, you can also subscribe to our podcast, our Political Rewind podcast, or listen to the show at the GPB News website. Okay?
Okay.
All right. Let's go to David Perdue, Senator David Perdue. We've all been so focused on illegal immigration and refugees, and in a little while we'll talk about the circuit court arguments that were made, the appeals court arguments that we all got to listen to last night over the Trump travel ban. But while everybody's focused on that, Senators Tom Cotton and our own David Perdue introduced a bill yesterday, Greg, that in fact, I think, I want to be careful, significantly, rather than severely, significantly reduces potentially legal immigration into this country.
Yeah, it's a pretty sweeping overhaul of components of the U.S. government's legal immigration system that have been intact for decades. It does cut by more than half the number of refugees permitted into the country, but it also abolishes a federal green card lottery program that was originally intended to boost more diversity. And it also codifies some of the more divisive immigration policies that, that Trump advocates. So it is a pretty far-reaching immigration legislation that has a lot of Republican support already.
And in all of that, it also reduces the numbers of people who can come into this country sponsored by family members. Family members already in the country will have a much reduced opportunity to have their family members abroad join them here. Yes?
Yeah, so I think, you know, some people are going to view that as pretty disruptive. And I think overall, you know, if this goes into effect, I think we'll have to see what the overall effect on the economy is going to be. The Silicon Valley, for instance, you know, is adamantly opposed to this because they recognize the value of their software engineers that are coming from other places and they just want to be able to hire the best talent possible. And, you know, part of that also means bringing spouses and children with them. So, you know, I think for those who are supportive of legal immigration and recognize the value that immigrants bring to the country, especially when they do it legally, this is going to be something that might raise concerns.
I think you've raised an issue that we're going to want to talk about, which is how the business community here in Georgia will react to their senator. But before we get to that, let's just listen to how David Perdue rationalizes, justifies this. He's going to talk about REACH. That's the acronym they're using to describe the bill. I frankly don't remember what the letters stand for, but that's what you'll hear him say first, and then he'll tell you why he thinks it's important.
The RAISE Act restores American legal immigration back to some of these historical norms by addressing the family immigration issue, by eliminating this outdated lottery system, and totally rationalizing the refugee program. This is a first step. It's not a sweeping, comprehensive attempt to solve all legal immigration problems, nor does it address illegal issues. We are simply trying today to bring a rational, compassionate approach to this different issue within the immigration conversation.
That's what I said. RAISE is the acronym. It is RAISE. Loretta, you work a lot with the business community here. And I'm wondering, so Perdue certainly is going to appeal to those Republicans who voted for Donald Trump in hopes that he would cut down on immigrants, whether they're legal or illegal, coming into the country to provide more jobs here. That's fine. But the business community and the technology community in Georgia, I can't imagine they're going to be happy with this.
Well, okay, so 2 points. So one on the families. You know, you are allowed to assist spouses and minor children into the country.
Well,
so
it's but under, at under lower this, numbers.
Under this provision,
but
right?
At reduced numbers, I believe.
Right. So the numbers are all going down to, as the senators say, to bring us back to normal historic immigration levels. We're right now at very high immigration levels, well beyond what has been the norm in this country.
So the 70s and 80s is what they say.
Right. And the senators have laid out, you know, for example, I'll go into that in a second. But this bill, as David Perdue specifically stated in the press conference, addresses non-employment issues. He acknowledged that there are concerns about H-1B visas, which address the high-skilled technology-type workers right. that are coming here for education and to start businesses that we want to be here and commercialize their intellectual capital. And then there are others. So this Senator Cotton has addressed this. He said this is about a merit-based approach rather than an unthinking immigration system. So people having to come into this country where they can provide benefit to our economic development system. So the bills and the components that are in this bill were taken from previous comprehensive immigration bills. So on a very high 10,000-foot level, what they're doing is beginning to break down those comprehensive bills that could not get traction in the Congress because they were just too massive into components. This first one, they're calling non-employment. It's about the families. It's about ridding Senator Cotton talked a lot about how the diversity program was being gamed. It was supposed to promote diversity, but most of the immigrants coming in are coming from Europe.
That's the green card lottery aspect.
Right, right. And so it's not a system that is working. It's not a legal system that is working. The refugees, yes, they're capping that at 50,000 per year. That is new, but that was in previous bills also. And then they'll begin to look at the employment pieces, which address H-1B, will be separate legislation.
Right,
security,
but they're heading that direction.
Right, they are. And so Senator Perdue has acknowledged that he's heard from both the technology community as well as from our agrarian community here, you know, that the ag business, they're going to have to address agricultural workers as well and what kind of work program we're going to have for those workers.
Yeah, I think we've seen that from both sides. I mean, it's a very important point, talking about the agrarian workers as well as the tech workers. Obviously, you know, I work in the tech space and has been in the space for a while, particularly here in Georgia. And, you know, if we talk at all about the H-1B visa program, we have to understand how it's exploded here in Georgia. I mean, with Fortune 500s coming in, a lot of the high-tech companies relocating to the Atlanta area. I mean, I ran into some numbers and I looked and, I mean, the top three companies in 2011 had respectively about 600 H-1B visas on hand here. In last year, the number is probably about 50,000. So it's exploding. I mean, it's growing continuously. What I'll also note, though, is when we talk about immigration and we're talking about, you know, how important it is that we have other people coming into this country. One of the factors I've looked at was, particularly with H-1B visa, is how much money they're making, right? And these are not $10 and $12 an hour jobs, right?
No.
You know, right now, the average salary is $81,000, you know, which is far and beyond the average income of the average person here in Georgia. But it's also a huge significant gain since 2011 when it was $65,000 a year. So you're talking about H-1B visa programs actually, you know, taking a lot of skilled labor that I think we could be having here in Georgia. So, you know, my own take on it is a little bit different, but I look to see what kind of legislation is coming down the pike because it's going to affect us a lot here.
No, first of all, Loretta, I see your point. And so as soon as you said it, I wanted to, like, you know, echo the clarification and thank you for the correction. I think the larger issue here is, you know, when most people are worried about immigration, they're worried about illegal immigration, and they see the issue related to that. So I think the question becomes, well, why are you worried about those who come legally to this country? Mm-hmm. And even though under this program, spouses and kids would still be allowed, people have social networks, especially extended family networks in different types of cultures, where in order to ensure somebody's kind of success and thriving here, it might be helpful for them to bring a community along, especially if we think about the extent to which immigrants tend to start small businesses here in the United States. Like, these are all things where they could be sponsoring a cousin or an adult child who's going to come in, be a partner in this business, and do a smashing job in terms of being successful and creating these businesses. So, you know, I don't view these folks who are coming under this legal program as being people who are drains on the economy. And so I think if we're going to think about optics, I think that that's something that's important because this isn't the part that most people object to. Most people are worried about those who are coming illegally, or they're worried about people who may be coming here legally for nefarious purposes. And so
well,
we know...
Well, I want to interrupt you there a second, just because a lot of illegal immigration, and I can't say, I should qualify that, I shouldn't say a lot. Some illegal immigration is the direct result of a broken legal immigration system. So there are a lot of folks that have come into this country, overstayed their visas, mm-hmm. whatever condition they were here, they came as minors, grew up here, became citizens. And they're waiting to bring others into the country, a fiance, a spouse, whatever, a grandparent. And they can't because the legal system is broken. I mean, I know this personally. I had someone that was close to me that took 2 years for her husband to get into this country. That's a broken system. That's a broken system.
Okay, but I want to go back to a point I asked you about originally. As businesses, and it's interesting to hear your take on in the technology aspect of this, Michael, because we know, Greg, that David Perdue has a direct pipeline to Donald Trump. We know that the president wants to expand the opportunities for Americans to get jobs. So even as we watch this aspect of illegal immigration remake take effect, it may not immediately affect employees who want to come into the country. But I can't imagine in the long run that technology companies who want some of the most skilled foreign workers, some of the highest level technology workers to come in here and work with them, or a Georgia Tech wants them to come in. I can't imagine they're not concerned about where this is
all
headed.
They're absolutely concerned. And I don't think David Perdue is at all naive about that. I mean, he's a Georgia Tech graduate, yeah. for gosh sakes. And when he was running for office, the tech community weighed in heavily with him on this issue. And so he's very cognizant about that. And I know this week, even when there got to be wind of this bill coming, folks from Georgia were calling in to him saying, what does this mean for H-1B visas? That was the primary concern. Now, you know, and for in Georgia, well, we've got all of these young people coming into, say, Georgia Tech from outside of the country, being educated, they're going through incubators, they're developing intellectual capital coming out of these universities, they're commercializing their product, and if they can't stay, they take it back to where they came
right.
from, and then that country flourishes
right,
from
is,
something we right. incubated.
Greg?
By the way, this also comes as corporate America is just starting to let its voice be heard on this issue. Mm-hmm. We saw about 100 tech companies, big, huge ones like Apple, let their voice be heard in a letter opposing Trump's immigration policy. And then if anyone watched the Super Bowl over the weekend, you saw commercial after commercial with a from many companies with a not-so-subtle imagery about, you know, preaching diversity and tolerance and immigration.
Well,
and Coca-Cola was one of those companies that came out in a letter and in a commercial, both, you know, with a critique in a way of Trump's immigration policy.
All right. We're going to keep track of this issue. There's a lot more to come on it. But thank you. I thought your conversation really helped me get a better grip on how I'm watching this unfold. So thank you all for that. Just quickly before we have to take a break. Yeah, Greg, both Barry Loudermilk, Congressman Barry Loudermilk, and Congressman Jody Heiss, this week are trying to cut government fat. First, Barry Loudermilk introduces legislation that would essentially kill the EPA. Let's listen to what he said.
They have turned into a big bureaucracy that is unaccountable. They are writing their own laws without going through Congress. They're overreaching continually over the power that the Congress has given them, and they've become counterproductive to preserving the environment. I mean, just recently they decided that they would reinterpret the law themselves that trailers that are pulled behind vehicles are now considered motorized vehicles and can be subjected to their regulations. You don't have to go back very far to look at the Gold King mine in Colorado. The EPA went in against the advice of an environmental contractor and told them, do not excavate that mine. If you excavate that mine, you could have a blowout and you could cause major damage. The EPA.
So that's Barry Loudermilk talking to GPB reporter Grant Blankenship. Where's this headed? I mean, this isn't really going to gain wide support on the Hill, is it, Grant?
I can't see that happening. But also, Jody Heiss, as you mentioned too, had a bill that would abolish the Department of Education on the
yeah.
same day
yeah.
that
yeah.
Betsy DeVos got confirmed. It's a sign that House, especially House Republicans, aren't content with the fact that there's a Republican administration who is in a Republican president appointing cabinet posts and Republicans to lead these posts, they still want to continue cutting federal government spending, even if it's just, you know, even if it's just sort of a fit for show.
And it tells us, doesn't it, Andre, an awful lot about where the minds of Georgia Republicans in Washington are fixed these days on this sort of thing.
Well, some. I mean, I think the bigger question here is that President Trump has issued an executive order that basically says, look, for every new rule, you got to cut two. So the question is, why not just try that out first and see how that works out before you start this wholesale destruction of departments? Now, on the other hand, this is also symbolic politics. So, you know, these are things that Loudermilk and Heiss have stood for. They can say that they've introduced this bill. It's not going to go anywhere more than likely, but they can at least come back to their constituents and say, here is how I stood up against government waste.
Well, I think we're going to see in the president's budget, the first budget, we're going to see some serious reductions in funding. And EPA is going to be one of those. Mm-hmm. I mean, we saw that as Governor Perry started going through his confirmation hearings and kind of being blindsided by the fact that there had been a proposed reduction of 15% or so in his
Department of Energy.
Energy, yes. So these agencies where they've been perceived to be over-regulated, inflated because of ideas around climate change, where the Obama administration did allocate additional resources. All of those agencies have got targets on their back from conservative groups in Washington, and we're going to see that reflected in the president's budget.
Michael, to quote Ronald Reagan, government is not the solution to the problem. Government is the problem.
Yeah, and if it was up to the Trump administration, none of those agencies would be able to speak or say anything about what's going on. So, you know, it's yet to come, right? We'll see. When that budget does come out, you know, I'm sure there'll be a lot of surprises, and I'll just get my other shoes on because I'm sure there's going to be more marches and rallies and protests and to come.
All right, we got to take a break. It's 2:47 on a Wednesday afternoon. This is Political Rewind. Back in a moment.
Hey, it's Peter Sagal. Resolved to lose a few pounds this year? How about a few thousand? Donate your old car, truck, or RV. Drop a lot of unwanted weight from your garage and support public radio.
Go to gpb.org/cars or call 877-GPB-1-CAR and thanks.
Break it down.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Greg Bluestein of the AJC, Loretta Lepore, Michael Owens, and Andre Gillespie are at the table for today's show. Greg, I want to do a very quick update. So if Tom Price is confirmed within the next few days, it will trigger Governor Deal's
writ.
Yes, writ to call for a special election in the 6th Congressional District. Where do we stand with that race right now?
The question is who's not running rather than who is. Yeah. There's about a dozen candidates at least in. We've already had State Senator Judson Hill in. You've got Karen Handel's likely to get in. Former State Senator Dan Moody's likely to get in. Bruce Lavelle, who headed Trump's Diversity Council, is likely to get in. There's a few other Republicans who are already in, including several Johns Creek Council members who are in. And then on the Democratic side, you've got a former state senator, a former state rep, and then this guy, John Ossoff, who's a former congressional aide who has the support of both Hank Johnson and John Lewis. So it's already a crazy race, and it's going to come down to all the candidates will be on one ballot regardless of their party, and it'll come down to a runoff.
That's what's really interesting about this is that you have so many folks in the race, and then you're going to have a runoff.
What they call a jungle primary.
Right. You are going to have a runoff, and you know it'll be interesting to see whether it's two Republicans that rise or if it's a Republican and a Democrat that rise into the primary. And it's interesting because that district in particular. Some folks are looking, I think, like the media at that district in particular because it narrowly went for Trump.
Mm-hmm,
to look at, you know, what kind of, you know, power or, you know, support does the president have still in that district or will that carry weight?
And what will be fascinating is given that one percentage point, that slim margin, what calculation do you make as a Republican mm-hmm. candidate as to how far you go in talking about your support for President Trump? I mean, you've mm-hmm. got to support him, but how far are you willing to go with that in a district that may not be that enthusiastic about him?
Well, you know what? I mean, I think the issue with this kind of race is that this special election electorate is not your presidential election electorate. And so you've actually got to figure out who's going to show
Absolutely.
Up and then what the fervor is for Trump in that district. So if you go in thinking all I can do is just kind of like redo everything that happened in November, you're going to miscalculate. And so I think it's really important to identify who are the types of people who show up in really, really, really off elections, and then what their ideological leanings are and what their issue concerns are before you, you know, decide where you stand.
And it's an establishment friendly district, right? That goes from East Cobb all the way through North Fulton, Sandy Springs, all the way up North Fulton, and then through North DeKalb and Brookhaven. It's the same district that elected Newt Gingrich, that elected Johnny Isaacson. That elected Tom Price by a 62% margin. But you're right, it's a totally different electorate that will vote in a special election that will probably be held sometime this summer with pretty low turnout.
Michael, you preside as Democratic Party Chair of Cobb over a portion of this district.
Yeah, I got about a third of that district. And I can tell you a couple of things. Regardless of whoever the Republican candidate, any of the Republican candidates are going to be huge Trump supporters, and we're going to keep saying that to the election day. And, you know, special elections, right? And we all know special elections are all about turnout, right? Mm-hmm. It's and as Dr. Gillespie said, it's about getting those voters that we know can show up and will show up on that day. So the electorate that we had in November will not be the electorate we have in May or June or whenever it's going to be. But that's going to be the challenge, right?
Is the
I'm sorry, go
no,
ahead.
No, go.
Well, I was going to say, I think we're going to be seeing a very short period of time for this race. I don't think the governor will want to see this protracted,
right,
this, you know, dogfight here.
Which would benefit,
here,
you would
right?
think, Republicans to have a shorter election a timetable, right?
Definitely.
Who have raised more money, and especially if you have a few of contenders who are putting a ton of money in.
That's what I wanted to ask Michael before we leave you completely. Is there going to be enough money for a Democratic candidate to run a healthy race in that district?
I have no doubt, because the major reason is because this race is no longer a local Georgia race, right? This has completely become a national race. Now, obviously, with Senator Price being nominated for the Health and Human Services Secretary, it's raised that awareness. So it's a nationwide campaign right now. I think we've seen candidates being able to raise money across the state or across the country, and you've also seen a lot of national news about it. So it's definitely, you know, there's enough money to go around for sure.
I think it's a national litmus test for if the Democratic Party is organized to be able to go into 2018. It's going to be one of those early bellwethers. But I also think on the other side that a protracted race benefits those who already have name recognition.
Sure.
So, you know, if you come and you represent a small area where nobody's heard of you before, it's probably going to be really difficult for you to get some traction. That's going to benefit those who have high profiles already.
All right. Obviously, that's going to be a fun race for us to cover here at Political Rewind, and we'll be watching it very carefully once the Tom Price is confirmed and the governor triggers the special election. We're not going to take a lot of time on the appeals court, the three-judge panel that looked at the travel ban, at whether the injunction that stops the travel ban from continuing should in fact be lifted or not, because you're hearing about it all over the national news. But let me just get, we all, I think, listened to the three judges. Greg, do you have an opinion? I mean, it sounded to me like you had we have a Carter and an Obama appointee who sounded to me as if they were a little bit more sympathetic to the argument of the Attorney General of Washington. And you had a George W. Bush appointee who was very, very hard on the attorney.
Yeah, it sounds like this will be a tough case for the Trump administration to win.
You mean this portion?
This portion of it.
Right.
This portion of it. And that's why I think we're already seeing a lot of the Trump tweets. Even today, there's several more. And he addressed the National Sheriff's Association again and said this is dangerous. If the appeals court lets this injunction stand, it'll be dangerous for our country. So I think they're already kind of reading the tea leaves.
Anybody else want to weigh in on what they heard last night?
Well, I think one of the most poignant points was the Bush-appointed judge who asked very specifically, how can you say this is a religious litmus test or a ban on Muslims when a small percentage of the Muslim population is being impacted by this?
I thought there was an awfully good response that the Attorney General could have made to that and didn't, the state Attorney General, which was that religious discrimination does not depend on whether it's most people in that class who are discriminated against. It's when any person is. Yes?
And it's hard to kind of, we go back to the campaign in which Trump obviously clearly said that, you know, and I'll paraphrase, but, you know, obviously a Muslim ban. We didn't, you know, this wasn't made up. This was something he obviously ran on and something he said on national TV, and it gets, replayed over and over and over again. So you cannot erase that from people's minds. So, you know, to now go back and say, well, this isn't, you know, this not the impetus of it, makes it kind of hard to say now that, no, it's not, when it was, you know, he clearly had said it was.
So I think the interesting part will be what the rationale is in the decision. And so can mm-hmm. we actually sure. trace the motivation for this travel ban back to things that were said on the campaign trail or things that have been tweeted? I think that's going to be an interesting thing. And then I think from a media side, does that then temper what President Trump says? Because, you know, he's garnered a lot of support by kind of being very loose with his talk. But if his loose talk had legal implications, yeah. then that might actually censor him.
140 characters at a time, right?
All right. We've only got a couple minutes. Greg Bluestein, Political Insider, had a great item this afternoon. I want to give you a chance to address it. I don't know if you specifically wrote it. We've all heard about Kellyanne Conway's Bowling Green massacre, which didn't happen. Insider, a little while ago, quoted our panelist, Patricia Murphy, mm-hmm. who's here quite frequently, who wrote for the Daily Beast that Sean Spicer has talked about Atlanta as the site of a massacre as well.
Talk about an undercover terrorist attack, one that didn't happen. And we're fortunate that it hasn't. But yes, there's yet another not completed terror attack that the Trump administration has cited, thankfully, in Atlanta.
Spicer said, I don't think you have to look any further than the families of the Boston Marathon in Atlanta, in San Bernardino, to ask if we can go any further. There's obviously steps we can take and should be taking. I think the president is going to continue to do what he does.
He was confusing Atlanta with Chattanooga.
And perhaps.
Yeah. That's what we think.
Have there been students who've been arrested around here?
No, I think the other question is, you know, they've been getting criticized, of course, because when they put out their list of the 58 terrorist mm-hmm. attacks they claim the media didn't cover, which the media in most cases did, they chose only Muslim on either Muslim or Christian victims. They didn't talk about other kinds of attacks where white supremacists mm-hmm. have been involved in terrorism. All right. I'm sorry. We're out of time completely. I would love for you all to talk for another hour because you're a really smart panel today. But thanks for being here, Greg Bluestein of the AJC, Loretta Lepore, Michael Owens, Andra awesome. Gillespie, thank you. Thank you to Tyler Morris, who's running our board, producer Lisa Clark, senior producer Jenny Amond. I'll say it one more time. If you can't be near a radio when we're on the air, you can subscribe to our podcast, the Political Rewind podcast. You can listen to our show online at gpbnews.org. Or if you're a reader of the AJC's Political Insider blog, which you ought to be, you can click on the link and listen to the show there. That's it for us for today. We'll be back Friday at 3 o'clock. Maybe by then we'll have heard the ruling from the three-judge panel on the federal court. See you then.